This is Molly Hemingway of The Federalist. Join me, my husband Mark of Real Clear Investigations, Kyle Mann of the Babylon Bee, San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod President Matt Harrison, and others for the 2023 Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 16th and Saturday, June 17th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Making the Case, June 16th and 17th in Chicago. issuesetc.org.
For some reason, John's gospel comes in for special scrutiny when it comes to liberal Bible scholars. It does stand out from the other three gospels in terms of its timeline and its outline, and it does acknowledge from the very beginning that Jesus is the Son of God. So maybe that's why it can't be misread that way. Maybe that's why liberal Bible scholars like to take pot shots at John's gospel and say, well, it was written very late and therefore is really just fan fiction, not an eyewitness account. Does the internal evidence of John's gospel itself, does it dispel that particular myth? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Tuesday afternoon, March the 14th, we're going to talk about the historical reliability of John's gospel. Shane Rosenthal joins us, formerly served as executive producer of The White Horse Inn. He's creator, host, and producer of the Humble Skeptic podcast and author of a recent column titled Authenticating the Fourth Gospel. Shane, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Todd.
What does liberal Bible scholarship usually do with the Gospel of John?
Well, there's a long history to that. If you go back a couple hundred years, it was very common, actually, for liberal German scholars to argue that the Gospel of John was a second century document, late second century, actually. And it wasn't until the turn of the century, last century, when this little fragment was discovered called the John Rylands fragment, that this is a copy of the Gospel of John that makes a pretty good argument that if this copy, you know, is found in this location, the original had to be earlier than that. And so even the very liberal Rudolf Bultmann ended up arguing that this put the Gospel of John at the latest around 82. So it was common before that period for people to date the Gospel of John very late. It's one of these inauthentic gospels, more like fan fiction than it is real history. Like the Gnostic Gospels are fan fiction. Jesus, when he's a kid, he's zapping his friends into goats and throwing stones in the air and they turn to pigeons, that kind of thing. It's people were fascinated by Jesus' story. So they wrote things that were imaginative creations. And so that's what liberals were doing with the Gospel of John. They were assuming that it was a late story that couldn't tell us anything about the historical Jesus. It was more about the doctrines and dogmas of the Christian church that it was sort of putting in the words of Jesus.
So why in particular John? Liberal Bible scholarship have attempted to discredit all four Gospels, but why does John come in for special scrutiny?
Well, one of the reasons for that is due to the fact that John's Gospel has always been viewed as a kind of very theological gospel. And so it doesn't just portray the narratives, but it also, you get a little bit more of this view as people have reflected on this gospel, that it's a spiritual gospel, that it's more theological, that there's more of an emphasis by the narrator to tell you the meaning and significance of the events he records. And so a lot of theologians, especially the German theologians last century, were trying to argue that this was a gospel that, again, reflects the later theology and the later theological developments of Christianity rather than being authentically the words of Jesus.
So we're going to be dealing with what is essentially testimony on the part of John, the author. How should we define testimony and how does it fit into the process of arriving at authentication?
Well, the word testimony, I think, is the key here because the claim that's being made in John's gospel is that this is eyewitness testimony. You get this in various sections of the gospel, like chapter 15. There's a saying by Jesus, when the Holy Spirit comes, he will lead you, he will give you complete remembrance, and he will also bear witness of me. And you too, you disciples, will bear witness of me because you have been with me from the beginning. That idea of bearing witness and testifying to the deeds and sayings of Jesus since the beginning is something you see in the apostolic testimony throughout the book of Acts. For example, Peter will say, God has ordained us as witnesses to testify all that Jesus did in Jerusalem, Judea. So they were the ones who God had chosen to testify about these things, which is, that's how you prove something that happened in, say, a court case. Deuteronomy says you have to have at least two or three witnesses. So God had said, okay, how about 12? So that idea, if you think of John's gospel this way, that it's sort of a written deposition of all the eyewitness testimony that goes back to the beginning stage before Jesus begins his public ministry, all the way back to the period in which, going back to the beginning of John the Baptist ministry. That's actually where most of the Gospels begin, except for those two Gospels that have a birth narrative. The ministry begins with John the Baptist. And so John's Gospel is claiming to be an eyewitness. If you look at chapter 19, he says, the author, the narrator says, he who has seen it has borne witness. We're speaking of the crucifixion and the piercing of his side with blood and water flowing. At the very end of the Gospel, he says, this is the eyewitness. This is the one who has seen these things, which indicates that the author himself is claiming to be an eyewitness. So either he's an eyewitness reflecting accurate testimony, or we should reject it as some kind of fan fiction or some kind of forgery.
So let's talk about the evidence that is really rather numerous in John's gospel. What is internal evidence, and how does it bear upon this conversation on John?
Well, I guess the way I like to say it and what I do in the article, Authenticating the Fourth Gospel, is I kind of try to give an analogy about authenticating a work of art. And so if you have, you may have seen a show like Antiques Roadshow where someone brings in a painting or some kind of an antique. And typically, one of the things they're going to talk about is the provenance. Is there a history? Are there documents that show where this piece, this desk, this painting has been over the years? That would be external evidence. And the internal evidence would be like the little characteristics of the desk, the painting, the antique jar. So if it's a painting, you're looking at the oils, the canvas, and the information presented that can get into the signature. These would be pieces of internal evidence that could point to the authenticity or the lack thereof for the artifact in question. And that's typically what appraisers are looking for, because they are the ones who've spent their lives studying the differences between real Van Goghs and fake Van Goghs. They know what the signs are, what kind of canvas it was printed on, what kind of oils and pigments were used. So that's the analogy I try to present as I'm looking at the Gospel of John. If we look at the internal evidence, the things that are included in the Gospel, can it? He give us trust? Are there any internal pieces of evidence that show he really was there in the early part of the first century in Palestine? And what I argue in the article is that there's a lot of evidence to that effect.
What are the hallmarks of a reliable witness, generally speaking?
Well, if you are in a court of law and you are listening to testimony from someone who is claiming to have seen the criminal near the spot of the crime, let's just say Professor Plum saw Colonel Mustard pretty close to the billiard room, and then later the billiard room is where we find the dead body. Your challenge as a juror is to say, is this person who's reporting this, what he's seen, is he trustworthy or not? And so one of the things you look for is you try to assess the credibility. You can't know for sure, because you can't go back in time. You can't know for sure if he's telling the truth about what he saw, but you can assess him as credible or not. And so a reliable witness is someone whose testimony is credible in light of the circumstances. So if you happen to have a receipt from 7-Eleven that shows Colonel Mustard was actually in the vicinity 5 minutes before the murder, the body was found, that gives plausibility to what Professor Plum said. It's something that can corroborate the testimony. This is what we find with the Gospel of John. There's lots of indicators throughout this text that corroborates the claim that he is a first century witness.
Let's talk about some of those. What things do we find in John's gospel that indicate John was a reliable witness, eyewitness?
Well, there's one of the things that's just fascinating is just all the research that's been done over the last 50 years, really, in terms of evaluating all these little details, such as first century architectural information, geographical information, city names, place names, botanical information. When you go down the list, just there are all kinds of little details in the Gospels that place this not just in Palestine, but in early first century Palestine. You know, a couple of examples with John's gospel, he is regularly focusing on the temple practice. Jesus is continually coming to Jerusalem for the temple feasts. And what you find when he comes to the temple is he has sayings that match the kinds of things that are going on in the liturgy. So even though he's not in Jerusalem in John 6, he's referring to the feast of Passover that is at hand. And he talks about the fact that he is the bread of life. And then in John 7, when he is at a temple festival, the Feast of Tabernacles, he talks about the fact that he is the living water. Well, at the Feast of Tabernacles, it turns out there was a particular liturgical celebration that is recorded in the Talmud, which included the pouring of spring water, which they called living water. So he is saying at that particular festival, he is the true living water. The other was just a type. And so the match between the particular kind of liturgical practice they had at that temple at that time, the author was making a connection there that seems to be relevant. Same with another reference in John's gospel. I think it's chapter 9, where Jesus says he is the light of the world. Later, there's a small hint that where the narrator says he said this in the treasury. And when you look at Josephus, I think it is, who says that in the treasury of the temple, during this festival, there were these four candelabras that were huge, and they poured oil in them. And he says there was not a courtyard in Jerusalem that was not lit up by the light of those candles. That's the place, the very place where Jesus says, I am the light of the world. So again, and there's another reference to the festival of dedication, where Jesus himself talks about the fact that he was dedicated and consecrated. It also says it was in winter in John 10 when that festival is referred to. So again and again, when you look for information about the temple liturgy, this particular author gets the customs and the information right. And that's just one category of is this author getting first century pre-destruction of the temple, that kind of Jerusalem, is he getting it right? And he gets it right every time you check.
So that also is a strong suggestion that John is much earlier than liberal Bible scholarship has said, and probably places John in Jerusalem before 70 AD.
Well, the best argument for that, I believe, is John chapter 5, verse 2. Because John, in that section, actually says specifically, there is in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, a place with five porticos called Bethesda. And people didn't know what a pool with five porticos, five covered porches, didn't really know, like, what would that be? Would it be like a Pentagon-shaped thing? They thought, one scholar actually argued that it was probably John's way of, since it's a late document, it's probably John's way of saying he's better than Moses. Moses had five books, and here is Jesus giving the new covenant, the new commandment. So this five, it's just a symbolic thing. And then sure enough, later that place, that pool with five porticos was discovered. It's actually like two pools with a portico going through the middle of it. So each side had a portico, but there's also one running through the middle. So we found this. So John's architectural information was exact, but then notice the present tense language. There is in Jerusalem. So imagine me saying, there is a place in New York called the World Trade Center with two twin towers. That way of saying it dates the sentence. And there have been those who've argued that that's a kind of literary technique, kind of like when we say Paul writes present tense. It's not literal. Well, Daniel Wallace, the New Testament scholar, did some research into this, and he couldn't find anywhere in Greek verbs of state, specifically the verb to be, eimi in Greek. He couldn't find any example of that verb to be used in that kind of historical present. And he says that he looked at it not just in the New Testament, but anywhere in Greek. So I think and he argues that that's a really good example that John had accurate firsthand evidence, or he was reporting accurately what the architecture was like there by the side of the temple. And that's the present tense language about Jerusalem and the temple sheep gate. So the sheep gate is still standing, and so is this portico. And that to me says, yes, we should date this before the Jewish war at the very latest.
Shane Rosenthal is our guest. We're talking about the historical reliability of John's gospel. He's also written recently about a database of first century names that shed some light on John's reliability.
Hey everyone, I'm so excited to come out to the 2023 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. It's going to be a blast.
Kyle Mann of the Babylon Bee.
I'm going to be giving a presentation called Making the Case Against Cancel Culture, where I talk about how we write comedy and how Christians need to use art and writing and all of that wonderful stuff to fight against cancel culture, and how we have to take a bold stand for the truth using the creative talents that God has given us. It's going to be a great time, and I'm so excited to come out and see everybody, meet everybody, and talk a little bit about how we write satire and use that to communicate God's truth.
You can meet and hear Kyle Mann of the Babylon Bee at the 2023 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 16th and Saturday, June 17th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org or by giving us a call, 618-223-8385. Making the Case, June 16th and 17th in River Forest, Illinois.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Making Disciples for Life. Across the nation, students are back in school in over 1,800 schools serving children in early childhood through high school. Students are thriving in programs of excellence in a safe, caring, Christian environment taught by dedicated teachers. To find a school in your community, visit lcms.org/schools. Connect today for information about a Lutheran school for the children in your family at lcms.org/schools.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons, or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
Todd Wilkin, you're connected to Issues Etc. We're discussing the historical reliability of John's Gospel with Shane Rosenthal. The early bird registration fee of $140 expires tomorrow, Wednesday, March 15th, for the 2023 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. We already have 360 paid registrants. Attendance is limited to 500. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, June 16th and Saturday, June 17th at Concordia University, Chicago. Making the Case begins with a live broadcast of Issues Etc. and ends with the Divine Service and an on-campus event for Lutheran singles. Find out more at issuesetc.org or by giving us a call, 618-223-8385. Making the Case, June 16th and 17th in River Forest, Illinois. Shane, you've written recently about a database of first century names that some researchers have compiled. How does that shed light on John's reliability?
Yeah, this is an argument that Richard Bauckham really fleshes out in his fascinating book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. But he's working off this database that was developed by an Israeli scholar, Tal Ilan, and the database contains over 3,000 names. They've collected them from coins, ossuaries, inscriptions, texts. So though Peter's name is mentioned, let's say, 18 times in one of the Gospels, it only appears in the database one time. So this database counts all the different Peters, ranks all the different names, male names throughout the New Testament, as well as other texts and documents and inscriptions. So you have this list. And so what you can do is you can rank which name is the most popular. And it turns out the most popular name in the first century Palestine was the name Simon, just like we find. It's the most popular name in that database. It's also the most popular name if you rank all the names combined from John's Gospel, the other three Gospels, and Acts. All the names in Acts and the New Testament, all the names, you put these together in a single database, and it looks almost identical to the top 10 names that we find in the other database. So if you and I were to try to write like a fan fiction set in a different time, if we were going to set it in the 1800s, we might think of names like Edna and Gertrude, names that aren't popular today, but we wouldn't get them if we had a whole bunch of different characters. We wouldn't get them in the right ratio. And that's what Richard Bauckham points out in his work, that this is something that shows this is real history. These are real characters. You can't fake this, because nobody could come up with this list when you combine all the documents into a single text. And so It just looks like the ratio is the same to actual history, which is a vindication that this is real history.
And that gets multiplied four times, because it's not just John's gospel, but it's all four gospels, men writing independently, coming up with the same names.
Yeah, and that's specifically, you know, five, if you include the second text, Luke chapter 2, Luke volume 2, you know, when you add all the names there too, because there are other Simons there, Simon Magus. So you have a lot of these different names that are authentic to the place and the period. And when you compare them, say, with these Gnostic Gospels, it's fascinating because the Gnostic Gospels don't have any of these little details about places, cities. If there are any additional names, they're not Palestinian names. They're sort of Balthazar and Denotus and all these different strange names that don't actually work because they're not part of that database of actual names. So it's an easy way to show that these are sort of later. They're not actually describing history. They're describing sort of this Gnostic theory put in the words of Jesus, you know, the secret words of Jesus to Thomas. If your listeners just want to get a sense of that, read them sometimes, because you'll find that Jesus will say things like, I am the Ogdoad who emerges from the Pleroma. That definitely doesn't sound Jewish. And then when you look at the other names, those other names aren't Palestinian Jewish names.
What is protective anonymity and how does it apply here?
This is a fascinating topic that I think is one of the crucial ways to vindicate these texts, the four Gospels, as real history. So I'll start with a way to evaluate this by just thinking about one scene in particular. Toward the end of the Jesus ministry, Jesus is arrested at the Garden of Gethsemane. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke say that one of the disciples took out his sword and attacked the servant of the high priest. And that's all they say. It just says one of the servants, one of Jesus' disciples. But it leaves the name out. John's gospel comes along, and John says Peter drew his sword and chopped off the ear of the servant of the high priest, and his name was Malchus. So John names names. And as you look at New Testament scholars, even liberal scholars, they say, you know, what's the reason for the difference there? And it seems like whether you're talking about, this goes way back. I actually saw this, people reflecting on this in the 1700s. And basically the idea is like this. If you're Peter, and if you're still in Jerusalem, in fact, Acts chapter 10 shows us that he actually was put into prison. If you have the threat of going to jail again, you're not going to put his name in a text where there's a crime attached. So they mention the crime, but they don't mention the person. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke are protecting Peter from that. In other words, leaving his name out is a good indication that he's still alive when they're written. We know he dies around 64 to 67. So that's one way to sort of protect Peter from getting in further trouble. And there's a fascinating passage, Acts chapter 10 or 12, I think it's chapter 12, where after Peter escapes from prison, he comes to the house where the disciples are meeting. He tells them what's happening. And then he, quote, Luke says he, quote, goes to another place. Church history tells us he goes to Rome, and he's the Paul will say, I didn't want to go to Rome lest I be accused of building on someone else's foundation. Church history fills in the blank and says that was Peter's foundation. Why didn't Luke mention that? Well, because there are a lot of Jews in Rome and he could have been escorted back. So they just left that information out. That's protective anonymity. John's gospel, though, doesn't have to be written after Peter's death. I think there's evidence in John's gospel toward the end that shows Peter also was still, from the narrator's point of view, Peter was still alive when he died. And that's right there at the end of chapter 21. It says, Jesus describes the manner of Peter's death. You know, they'll stretch out your arms and they will take you to a place that you don't want to go. The narrator steps in and says, this he said to show the kind of death he was going to die. That's the way it reads in English. In Greek, it actually says, this he said to show the kind of death he will die. He will glorify God. It's complete future tense. In other words, from the narrator's point of view, Peter's death is still future.
A few thoughts on the anonymity of John's authorship, or near anonymity.
Well, there's a debate in New Testament scholarship about who wrote the Gospel of John. Most conservatives tend to think that it's John the Apostle, and there are some who argue that it's a different John, and that sort of explains the differences between the Synoptic Gospels and John's Gospel. The Synoptics are more, they're Galilean writers or the disciples thereof. Then John's Gospel is written by a different John, maybe a John who was a Jerusalem disciple. So wherever you land on that debate, the interesting thing is nowhere in John's Gospel do you find this is written by the Apostle John, the son of Zebedee. So you have to kind of look for clues as to the authorship question, which is a fun debate. And you know, you have to triangulate, because basically the gospel says this is the disciple who's writing this, and he's claiming to be the one who leaned at Jesus' side, the one Jesus whispered to at Last Supper about the identity of the traitor, and that Peter is the one who has to sort of say, what did he say? And so this one who is close to Jesus, he's the one writing this gospel. We're never told specifically this is John the Apostle. That's, people have to triangulate to get there. And I think it's a very legitimate question to ask, is this a different John? And church history says, you know, there was another John. Maybe it's this other guy. The point I try to make in this article is that this is not the kind of thing. Think about the average Gnostic gospel. There are all these fake fan fiction gospels that were written 150, 200 years later, all start off by saying, you know, this is the gospel of Thomas. It's the secret esoteric teachings that nobody else got that Jesus gave specifically to Thomas. So it's not going to be the gospel of Balthazar, this unknown disciple, because nobody would trust that. They don't even know if there really was a Balthazar. So it's the gospel of Thomas, the gospel of Judas, the gospel of Mary Magdalene, the gospel of Philip. All these fake fan fiction gospels are giving you the name of a disciple you already trust. John's gospel doesn't do that. It seems like he is sort of protecting his own identity, even by the way he narrates his gospel. He didn't have to reveal who he was because he had authority in his own community. And when the gospel was published and circulated, it had authority. But he doesn't sort of claim this authority. Now, that's not the kind of thing that a forger would do.
Finally, with about 30 seconds, in general, how does John's gospel compare with these writings that we know to be later fan fiction versions of the life of Jesus?
Well, that's the great thing about studying this gospel. It's hard sometimes to focus on these little details because Jesus is such a powerful character. His words are, he has the words of eternal life. So sometimes they overshadow what's going on in the background. But when you take the time and you study the background and you look at these little details, they really place you in first century Palestine. City names like Bethesda, Bethsaida, changes in name, the way that towns were named. This particular author gets it right. Botanical information. He talks, you know, we celebrate Palm Sunday. We're going to celebrate it coming up here soon. There's only one gospel that mentions palm branches. And it turns out it's John's gospel. And we know from the Talmud that they did actually wave palm branches at festivals like this.
Shane Rosenthal formerly served as executive producer of The White Horse Inn. He's creator, host, and producer of the Humble Skeptic podcast. He's author of a recent column titled Authenticating the Fourth Gospel. You'll find links to this column and to the Humble Skeptic podcast at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Shane, thanks.
Thanks a bunch, Todd. It's great to be with you.
Wednesday on Issues Etc., we'll look forward to Sunday morning, according to the one-year lectionary, talking with Pastor Peter Bender about Jesus feeding the 5,000 in John chapter 6. And we'll respond to your email, talkback@issuesetc.org, and the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
When I serve
listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
This is Jeff Schwarz, General Manager of Lutheran Public Radio, with a message for listeners in the Mountain and Pacific time zones. We pledge to have Issues Etc. podcasts posted daily, no later than 5 p.m. Mountain, 4 p.m. Pacific. This will allow you to download and listen to the latest Issues Etc. podcasts weekdays during your evening commute. Again, if you live in the Mountain or Pacific time zone, download Issues Etc. before you leave work and listen during your drive home.